Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 117 of Registry Matters. It's the weirdest thing in the world. This is actually a Saturday night, Larry.
It is, and I'm glad to be here, but next week may be a different story.
Why? I don't know about next week yet.
It's the state pre-primary convention, and I'm trying to think of a reason not to go, although I'm a delegate.
Oh, okay. You're not going to have some sort of crazy caucus where everyone has to run to the other side of the room because that's their guy, and then when their guy's not the guy, then they have to go to the other part of the room?
Well, we do vote on candidates, but it's not quite that crazy.
The Iowa caucus thing still kind of cracks me up. But yeah, today vote, is the South Carolina primary, isn't it? Do you have any...
It is.
Have you seen any stats of who's winning what where?
Well, this one should be Biden's to lose with Jim Clyburn's endorsement and the right. Black population and the loyalty that he has from the Black community. This should be his to lose.
I heard an interview with Clyburn. He's an interesting fella.
Yes, he is. He is, and as far as I know, I don't recall that Biden has ever won a primary before in his various quests for president.
You are 100% right. I heard that he has never won a primary.
I was thinking that I don't recollect him ever being declared the winner of a primary.
Yep. All right, Larry, I have a surprise for you. And I came across this little, it's a 1 minute long video. And I hope that you've maintained integrity and you have not watched this yet.
But well, how would I watch it if I don't know where it is?
Well, I put the link in there about a half hour ago. So you can click on it now. And what I would really like you to do is I would like you to describe what you're watching as it happens. So, of course, go over to the show notes and find the link. And you can see what's going on. And I would like you to describe what you're watching. It's nothing bad, nothing like that, but it's about wealth inequality.
Okay, so that would be the Reddit link here?
Correct.
Where your cursor is. Now, will the people hear what I'm watching, or will just me? Will
I be no, and I've provided them with the link, so I just want you to describe it, so if you want to watch it at home while this one-minute video goes on, you get, you know, have fun with that. But no, they won't hear it.
So should I watch the entire minute and then describe it, or watch it?
No, okay. As you're watching it. And it's going to go kind of quick, but I think you'll be able to pull it off.
So it's great. It doesn't play, so I don't have to watch it.
It doesn't play at all?
I see a Rice Part 2, and I see counting Jeff Bezos. Click on what?
Click on the video in the center.
There's no video to click on.
There is not?
Let me close this at the top here. I know I'm using this outdated browser.
Yes.
And that may be the problem.
One of these days, Larry, we'll get you fixed.
Yeah, I can't play it, so you're going to have to play it.
But there's no sound. It's totally like a video representation of the whole thing. All right. Well, then I guess I will describe it. All right. So I want you to follow along with me, Larry. The scene starts where on a table, there is a piece of rice and there's a marker over it. And the rice, it says that one piece of rice equals $100,000. Sitting next to it are 10 grains of rice and it represents $1 million. I'm pretty sure you're with me so far because you're smarter than the average bear.
Okay, so far so good.
Okay, good. So then we move over to, I don't know, it looks like if you cupped your two hands together, you would have $1 billion of rice. Then, as the video goes on, we're only at 10 seconds, the guy gets in his car and he goes to the local Target and he starts buying up some things to measure how much $1 million of rice would cost. I'm sorry, $1 billion of rice or whey. I'm sorry. So it's 215 grams is how much $1 billion of rice would weigh. Then you see him going over to the dry goods section and he buys a 50 pound or 35 pound bag of rice. And then there's a tarp on the ground in his house and he dumps out the rice and goes to measuring how much rice would be required to meet the net worth of Jeff Bezos. And I mean, I don't even know how to describe it, but it is like, you could probably like curl up in a fetal position and lay on it. I mean, it's the size of someone like curled up in a ball. It's gigantic to equal $120 billion of worth in the arena of measuring compared to rice. The reason why I wanted to bring this up and the reason why I wanted you to describe this was because we have like this whole disparity with some taxes and wealth inequality and all this stuff. And I wanted you to pontificate on the amount of money that that would be compared to the peons that us normal folks have. That's all I was trying to do, get out of this from this little video.
Well, I did switch browsers and it is playing. So I'm seeing what you've described.
Well, do me a favor, Larry. And can you start over from scratch? Even though I know that I've already described it, but I want it from your voice.
So, well, I saw the same thing you described, these mountains of rice. And I don't know that my comments would be what people would want to hear. I don't have any problem with people accumulating wealth. I have the problem when they pretend like they've paid tax on it when they haven't. And then they get angry at the thought that they might get taxed on it. And that's the problem I have. Like I was hearing on a financial program just this past week about tax deferment, and like when you do a 401k, they've raised the age from 70 and a half, where you have to start taking distributions, to 72. Are you aware of that, or you're too young still that doesn't matter to you?
I mean, it's still a ways off for me, but I understand that it's happening.
Well. The issue I have with it is that the program, the person doing the program, completely cast the situation erroneously from how it really is. He said, there's one thing that irritates me is the IRS telling me that I have to take money out of my retirement that I don't need. And that's really not what's going on. What the IRS is doing is they're saying, look, you citizen, the taxpayers have carried you for all these years. You've been able to shelter this money, and it's been able to grow for 30, 40, or 50 years. And the capital growth that you have earned on that is taxable. So therefore, the way we begin to tax it is to force withdrawals. Now, since people don't want the IRS to force them to withdraw their money, then there'd be another way to do it. You could just say, well, you don't have to withdraw any of it, but we're just going to begin to tax it based on the present day value of the capital gains that you have. But they completely spin a web that's completely different than the reality. And it's like the Buffett rule when he talks about that people who have entirely stock dividends and capital gains distributions and capital gains where they sell a stock that they paid $100 a share for $1,000, a tenfold increase, that they pay a 15% capital gains rate. That's the maximum rate. He's saying that the person who derives their living doing that is paying a lower rate than the secretary who services that person, because they're paying a 7.65% Social Security rate, which is exempt from, it doesn't get taxed because it's not employment income. And then depending on their level of income, they may be at a 20, 25, 28, 29% tax bracket, where if you're getting all your income from financials, you're only paying a 50% rate. So you could be paying half the rate. I don't have any problem with people having great wealth. I have a problem with them pretending like that they're paying taxes on it when they're not.
I understand. That is 100% what I was looking for. I don't personally have any problem with him making all of the money under the sun too, but it's the other part of that you were just describing that is somewhat frustrating.
They create this myth that it's like when wealth, you know, the conservatives are good at describing things with names that are offensive, like the death tax. It's not a death tax at all. I mean, it's levied at the time you die, but your appreciated value of those assets that have grown over your life at some point get taxed minus the exemption, which has gone up very high. Now, it's not a level that I can even relate to before there's even any tax in an estate. I mean, it's up to a couple million dollars, maybe.
I want to say it's five. That's the number that
I mean, I was going to say. But they make it sound as if that the mere fact of you're dying is causing you to be taxed because the IRS just can't help getting their hands. And they act like the IRS is some monolith entity that takes the money out to Vulcan somewhere. The IRS uses the money. The IRS uses the money. to pay for the programs that we demand from our government, and which we're still not taxing ourselves nearly enough to pay for the services that we're demanding from our government.
Are you saying that we need to have taxes to pay for things like roads and schools and things?
Well, I'm saying that the spending that we are not willing to cut is, at the last conclusion, last fiscal year, just shy of $1 trillion more than what we're willing to impose in the way of taxes on ourselves. That's what I'm saying. I'm not set pronouncing a value system of whether all those things are worthwhile, but we don't seem to be able to cut them.
I understand. Anything else? I want to move on to this next thing. These are completely non-registry related. This one,
You're just trying to have me reveal my political leanings so that people can throw darts at me.
That, and also see if we can drive listenership all the way to zero as quickly as possible.
Well, you're doing a good job.
You've heard of the coronavirus, I assume?
I think I've heard of it, yes.
Okay. I wanted to, the news media, and I'm not really all into this fake news thing, but the media is pushing out there, like, you know, this whole big epidemic going on. And I am not trying to discount that it is or isn't an epidemic, but the number of deaths in the world is in the single-digit thousands. And by all means, that is a lot of people that have died. However, if you compare it to the number of people that died from just our normal flu season in 2018 and 19, which is 34,000 people. Yeah, 34,200 deaths during the 2018-19 influenza season. So I just wanted to make that comparison just to, like, just put the brakes on a little bit, that we are not all of a sudden going to all die from this thing. But the bigger point is our government's response to that. We've talked about delegation. This goes back to Gundy. And I'm just of the firm belief that our CDC and any sort of tangentially related agencies are by far the most equipped organizations to deal with this, to set up triage, to just to set up like a game plan, versus having the 535 knuckleheads in Congress trying to set whatever the agenda would be, like trying to vote on, hey, we needed to research this. I just think that the CDC would be the right organization, which goes to delegation. And I was hoping that you would fill in the gaps on what I've just described.
I think that you've brought in something that's it's kind of spot on for the analogy. The Congress could not begin to have 535 members debate what needs to be done. They can debate the price tag and decide if it's a priority for the nation, if they want to go deeper into debt to pay for it. But in terms of micromanaging this potential, it has the potential, according to the experts, to be a significant virus that affects a large number of Americans. Right now, it's relatively contained here in this country. What are there, 60 cases and
something like
one
that,
case, sure. One case that was not directly related to someone who had been exposed.
That's the scary piece,
which means it may transmit itself and be what they call it, mutate. I'm no health expert, but this delegation is that. The national direction will be set by the president and by the Congress in terms of how we want to make this as a priority. But in terms of the actual details of how that they're going to execute this will not be anything other than delegated over to the public health apparatus, and they will figure out what to do. And that's the only way it could work.
And to piggyback on top of that, the executive branch would be like, hey, we need to do this. Or he would have, I'm assuming he would have the ability to write an executive order that says this money is going to be allocated to do this thing, just like he's doing with the wall. But I assume that would be a correct. So he could declare some kind of national emergency and start directing funding in an emergency fashion to go take care of things.
Well, the again, I'm not an expert enough to know what all he can move around within executive agencies, but there's some always discretionary money that can be moved around within the various executive departments. And the president can do that. But not only the president can do that, the president has the bully pulpit to ask Congress for more money. And the president also has the entire government apparatus at his disposal in terms of moving whatever personnel and equipment we need to move and to prioritize that and break any log jams that may be developing, because sometimes mm-hmm. the agencies don't work very well together. We learned that in 9/11 when we had all these agencies that were responsible for various components of passenger safety, and that they couldn't even talk to one another in some cases.
I'm assuming that this has a similar profile to when a hurricane shows up, or 9/11, as you just said. I assume, you know, so that would, whatever the other apparatus, the mechanisms, the tools that they have to do those things, all those would be able to be engaged. Anyway, all my whole point was, is like delegation, CDC, smart virusologists, whatever those people are called, that are researching, trying to figure out how to keep us safe. They're specialists in those fields. And I would think that we would want the specialists and the experts to be the ones that are driving that bus.
Well, people who think that they don't want any delegation would not really like the country they would be living in if everything had to be decided by Congress. They would find it to be a very inhospitable place to live if that were the case.
And my closing remarks: wash your hands and cover your coughs. And wearing a mask is probably not going to help anything. But that's
well, you can't find it anyway.
That's true. The company I work for, they happen to sell masks like that for like paint booths for automotive stuff. And yeah, they're gone. Cannot buy them. It's not a thing. All right. So next up on the list would be, I have it written down as Cobb County Registrant Shenanigans. And so I will let you take it from here about some letter writing that's going back and forth between you and, or not you, but Narsal and the Cobb County folks.
And who is Narsal anyway?
NARSAL would be the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws, if I'm not mistaken.
And Registry
of which
Matters.
You have a fairly significant role there.
But Registry Matters is not affiliated directly with NARSAL.
That is correct.
So, well, what to bring people up that may have not listened, back in late January, we sent a letter to the Cobb County Sheriff. Cobb County, for those who don't live in Georgia, as a suburban Atlanta county, very affluent. It's a cosmopolitan melting pot. It used to be a conservative bastion. It's much more of a diverse county now. And I think the population is somewhere between 700,000-800,000 people. It's relatively relatively large urban county. They have about 600 people on the registry, and the practices they have developed are very alarming. Now, we're going to get emails telling us that they do this all over the country, and they probably do. It's just that Georgia's on my radar because we're already fighting in Butts County and Spalding County regarding the Halloween signs, and I'm a lot more familiar with Georgia than some of the other counties where egregious things may be happening. But the Cobb County Sheriff has decided that they can visit anytime, day or night, and we've heard rumors of as late as 11:30, 12 o'clock at night to do a residency verification, and we've been provided copies of the forms they leave on the door saying you must call within 24 hours, and must implies if you don't make the call, something is going to happen. Must is pretty straightforward, and then they have required people to disclose their hours of employment, their exact work schedule, and all these things that we've heard about are not in the Georgia statute. And we like fighting things when there's not a statute that supports it. Statutes can be invalid, but they're presumed valid upon enactment until they're challenged on a constitutional ground. But if you're requiring someone to do something that's not in statute, your odds of winning the case go up exponentially, because that means it's being imposed without legal authority. So you don't have to get into the constitutionality of the law. You just simply have a renegade law enforcement agency that's doing what they want to. So Cobb County has decided that you will verify more frequently than is required, and that you will disclose your hours, and that you will be available to the Cobb County authorities anytime they feel that they would like to visit with you. So we wrote them a cease and desist letter back in late January. They responded, their county attorney responded, which was actually a surprise. Usually they ignore us. And I think maybe because they got TV attention, we did a press release saying, if you don't respond, the next step may be litigation. We got a response, and the response was so disingenuous, they cited a made-up authority that they could do what they want to. So we sent a second letter this past Friday letting them know that what they cited and what they allege as authority, the Federal Adam Walsh Act, does not give them the authority, that they claim that Cobb County as a separate jurisdiction can do what they want to. But the only problem is Cobb County's Sheriff's Department is not a jurisdiction. Cobb County is not even a jurisdiction as far as federal SORNA. Georgia's a jurisdiction as far as federal SORNA is concerned, but Cobb County is a political subdivision of the state of Georgia. And so we told them that they were wrong on many counts, and they said they didn't know what constituted reasonable hours. So we defined what we thought were reasonable hours, and we figured that if you go out and ask a person what reasonable hours are, you could probably get a pretty good consensus just by going and asking Cobb County. If someone's going to knock at your door to visit, what would be the hours that you would want the knocks to stop? And you'd probably get something in the neighborhood between 7:30, 8, 9 o'clock at night that they wouldn't want anybody, wouldn't want visitors knocking at their door unexpected. And probably not before about the same time in the morning. I doubt most people want visitors before about 8 o'clock in the morning. So I'd say 8 to 8 would be reasonable hours. But so we tried to help them understand what reasonable hours are. But we told them in the letter that we're going to be reaching, we asked them to join us in a joint letter since they claim that people are not threatened with prosecution if they don't make these phone calls after these flyers are left. They said that that's not a threat, it's just simply a request, although it says must. So we asked them if they would want to join us in a letter to the offenders in Cobb County saying that you're not required to call and they would like to inform the offenders that they're not required to give their employment. They're not going to do that in all likelihood. But then we told them if they don't respond to us within 10 days, we're going to respond with a letter to everybody in Cobb County. It's on the registry. And we're going to ask people to keep diaries of their encounters with law enforcement. So that means if you're listening in Cobb County or any county for that matter, but particularly Cobb County, get used to the idea that you need to keep a diary of what your interaction is with law enforcement when they're doing their so-called residency verifications. You do not go to the paper shredder and take anything they leave and shred it. It may be valuable evidence that we'll use later in terms of demonstrating their overreach and their harassment and what they're doing. If you shred the evidence, we will not have it available to us.
We can't use a time machine to get back to that?
No, and I'm boggled that so many people shred evidence. They say this stuff is just over the top. They're violating my rights. And I said, well, in what way? Well, they came to my house 7 times in the last 2 months. I said, well, were you not there? No, they weren't. Well, but they left a flyer. What did you do? I shredded it.
So this is not the appropriate activity to take when they leave something and you're trying to say this is against my rights, rules, whatever.
I don't know how you would be able to litigate. It seems like to me the your memory would not be nearly as well, would not serve you nearly as well as actually having that document, putting at least the time that you received it to the best of your knowledge. Now, some of you have cameras on your house and you'll know exactly when they were at your house because you've got Ring doorbell and the doorbell rang and you looked and you saw the uniforms. And when you get home and you find the flyer, if you chose not to talk to them through the doorbell app, you know what time they left it. But we're going to need as much documentation as we can get in terms of how often they're coming, how many officers are coming, what agencies they're representing, if they're being intimidating, if they're demanding to come in, if they're somebody standing out in the yard with their hand on a weapon, if your kid starts crying because there's 7 people at the door demanding to come in to take a look around. We're going to need to know all that stuff. We can't win a lawsuit if we don't know what they're doing.
I'm reminded, I'm not really a big Judge Wapner fan, but, you know, da-dum-dum. And I think the person that came to the table with the most documentation, true or false, won.
That would be a good analogy. And folks, your memory is not going to serve you nearly as well as writing it down. If nothing else, get a 5 cents manila folder and call it registration file. And if nothing else, pull off a piece of legal paper when you have an encounter, and write down who came to the door, if you can get a name, what agency they're from, or if there are multiple agencies, if they come with the marshals and they come with probation, parole, put all that down. And the funny thing is technology is so good today that everybody has a cell phone practically that'll record. Everybody can record these encounters if they choose to. There's no law against you recording what's going on in your house. You've got a camera outside. There's so many people have cameras on their house. They can fire these things up, or if they're not already running. The documentation we can develop is far better than what we could have done 10 or 15 years ago.
But Larry, all of this is so inconvenient. I was watching the football game or the tennis match, or I was playing dominoes and these people came to my door. I can't be bothered with all that.
Well, if you can't be bothered with it, then I guess we won't be able to help.
But I need you to help. Like, do something. It's unconstitutional.
Well, it in some cases, it might be. In Cobb County, we don't know how far that they're taking this. We've got enough anecdotal complaints of people saying what's going on. And it's amazing the neighboring county of Gwinnett, which is not far from Cobb, from all accounts, the same practices don't even in Gwinnett County. They take the attitude that if it's not specifically in the registry, we don't do it. But like people say, well, I got to go to park. And they say, well, is there anything in the registry that says you can't in the statute? And well, if you're not under supervision and you don't have any conditions on you, you can go anywhere anybody else can go. You just can't live within so many feet of the park if your conviction occurred after certain key dates, which Georgia's a mess of dates depending on when your behavior occurred. And there's escalating levels of prohibitions of what you can do the more recent your crime is, as far as the registry requirements. But Cobb County, hopefully they will negotiate with us, and hopefully they'll stop going out to people's houses late at night, and hopefully they will quit threatening people with arrest if they don't complete this registration process. I can only speak for myself. I never advise anybody to do anything. But I'm not going to come out of my house at 9 o'clock at night and sign a form that a sheriff is holding with a flashlight. I'm not going to do it. It's not required. Until you can cite in the statute that I have to sign your paperwork and I have to come outside with my PJs on and deal with you, I'm not going to. I'll do what I'm required to do, which under Georgia law is to visit the sex offender office either once or twice per year. And it's within 72 hours of your birthday if you're an annual registrant, and on the second time if you're a predator. I don't know when they mandate the second visit, but other than that, you don't have to. There's nothing in the Georgia sex offender registration statute that requires you to sign their paper or engage them in conversation or to invite them into your home.
That requires a certain level of, I've got a new word for you, chutzpah, that you would have to just know the law inside and out, and then perhaps talk to a Larry kind of person to go, hey, not that you're advising them legally, but you know, hey, can you be my role model, Larry? Like, what would you do under these circumstances if it were you? Just to get, like, you are going to encounter them and they're not going to be friendly with you, but you are not going to be wrong. I'm not sure if you'll win or not, but I mean, that's something that someone has to be able to do to know whether they're right or wrong in the condition.
Well, I tell people up front, I'm not advising them. I'm only telling you what I would do, but they're going to retaliate. I also tell you that if you don't take that clipboard and that flashlight and sign that document, what they're going to do is not going to be pretty in most cases. They're probably not going to put you in handcuffs because they don't have anything to charge you with. There's no law being violated. But what they are going to do is they're going to sit there with their stopwatch and hope that you're a few minutes late on your 72 hours, that you don't get in there within 72 hours. Or they're going to come out and they're going to visit with your neighbors when you're not home, and they're going to go say, they're going to imply by, they're going to knock at the door and say, you know, we haven't been able to connect with Andy. He's ignoring us. We're pretty sure he's there, but he won't answer. But we haven't heard from him. And he's kind of a little bit on the spooky side, a little bit. You know, we're just kind of concerned. Have you seen anything that's the least bit unusual? Yeah, here's a special number you can call it. That's what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are not going to want to go through that. So it's easier just to open the door, to sign the thing, and have them be on their way.
God, it's so hard. You know, just like when you get pulled over for a speeding ticket, your heart starts racing. And you either know you're in the wrong and you're going to try and get out of it, or you literally have no idea what's wrong and you hope it doesn't escalate. Obviously, we know that people are getting shot by police these days for minimal reasons. And so you want to, you know, put your hands above the steering wheel. You want to do everything that looks like you're complying to keep them from pulling guns and weapons and so forth out. It's just very challenging, Larry, like you're describing. You know, they're saying, hey, it's 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, we're knocking on your door, we need you to sign this thing that verifies that you were here. And you're going to stand your ground saying, I'm not signing that because you don't have the authority to be here. And obviously you have to do it in a super de-escalating fashion. It would be very hard to do without training, practice.
It is indeed. And that's a good point, because I would start not by escalating, but by de-escalating. I would say, well, now I just want to have a conversation with you about what you've knocked on my door, and it's 11:45 at night. Every dog in this neighborhood is barking. Mm-hmm. My family has been woken up by your intrusion, and I don't mind you coming to verify. You're just doing your job because that's what they're doing. And believe it or not, people in America follow their instructions and do what they're told, just like they do in other countries. And I appreciate that you're just doing your job, but I would like for you to go back and tell your command staff that this is not the way to do their job, because I'm being nice to you this one time. But if you knock at my door again this late at night, I'm not going to be nice to you the next time.
Are you threatening the police, Larry? I mean, that's almost going to be their response.
I'm telling you a reality of the situation, that knocking at my door at 11:45 at night is not appropriate. Every dog in the neighborhood's barking. There's lights coming on all around us. This is spooking the neighbors. It's spooking my family. I'm telling you, if you come to this door again at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, I'm not going to be nice to you. I would appreciate if you go back and tell your command staff that what you're doing is not appropriate, and ask them if they will reconsider this, because if you want me to interact with you appropriately, you've got to show respect for me, because A, I don't have to do this. I'm not required to interact with you at any time except in the sheriff's office once a year or twice a year, whatever your obligations are. So I'm trying to be as nice as I can be, but I'm telling you that this is a two-way street. I need some respect from the sheriff's department also.
Don't you think they're going to take that back to the mothership and then they're going to come back and be more assholic?
They probably will. But that's, I'm saying, I don't want to try to start escalating. I'm trying to de-escalate.
Yeah.
I'm trying to tell them, look, I want to be nice to you people, but I need you to show some respect from your side also.
Brenda says, I would not have the brains to put that together at midnight.
So
I'm pushing back on you as hard as I can. I 100% intellectually and rationally agree and respect everything that you're saying. Real world, your heart is thumping and you are in the fight or flight mode and you're going to actually tell somebody to FYP and you're going to slam the door and things are going to get really bad fast from there.
Well, I'm hoping you don't slam the door and I'm hoping that it doesn't escalate. But escalation is coming from them if they choose to escalate. I'm trying my best to de-escalate by saying, here's the problem you've created.
Yes. I agree. Understand. And yeah, I'm pretty sure that's it. So they haven't written you back. The letter they wrote you back was to say ill-informed, to put it mildly.
It was a very, I took it as a very condescending letter from an attorney who knows way less about SORNA than what NARSL would know. And the only reason that this attorney knows anything about it is because this letter was handed off by the sheriff's department saying, is there anything here? And for them to cite stuff is just simply not the way it is and tell us that we're not informed about SORNA really irritated me. I found it to be quite offensive. And I took a week to write the letter just so I could try to write it without being as irritated as I initially was. But it was to me a letter filled with disingenuous. Either the person doesn't understand it or they were trying to blow smoke and mirrors against an organization that's well-equipped and that's not going to take their smoke and mirrors and go away. In fact, we're going to do just the opposite. We're going to come back at them like we did, and we're going to go to the next level, if they don't work with us, of contacting all the offenders in Cobb County and seeing if we can get them to keep diaries and work with us. Now, if it turns out, we can't predict what 600 people are going to do. There's one thing I can't predict. There will be some offenders who will take our letters to the sheriff's office right away and say, you're not going to believe this. Have you ever heard of these people? That I know is going to happen. But in terms of how many people will keep diaries, I don't know that. All I can tell you is if this behavior bothers you, and which we get enough complaints that we hear that it bothers you immensely, then you're going to have to do a little bit of work because we can't keep the diary for you. We will not know when they knock at your door. Therefore, if it bothers you as much as you say it does, then we're going to need a credible percentage of people in Cobb County to keep the diaries so that we can measure the magnitude of the problem, so we can figure out what the strength of our cause of action, what our causes of action might be, and what the strength and likelihood of us succeeding might be. We won't know that till we gather the information.
And your reply was, did you have any help being restrained on SNARK?
Well, everything in NARSL is a team collaboration, so we don't ever have a person correspond by themselves. That's one of the things we try to guard against is an ill thought out piece of correspondence. So yes, I do. But that's just the corporate culture at NARSL. We do that with every piece of that.
Well,
takes a bit longer. But yes, I did have help. But that's the way we do things. I mean, it's not anything unusual. You're making it sound like that. But that I had to be particularly restrained. We do everything in a team collaboration.
No, I get that. I'm just referring to, like, she got under your skin with this letter, and so I'm just sort of trying to hint around that. You had to, not that it was not the collaboration part, but you had to help keeping the tone a certain way.
I think the tone was pretty good when my first product. I think that it was well restrained to start with, but we organized it better through the revisions and communicated a more coherent message. But it takes us longer to do things because we do a team collaboration rather than individuals.
Sure. Anything else? I mean, we've been on this for like a half hour almost.
I think we've covered this pretty well.
And you had something else. Was that an 11th Circuit decision?
The Halloween case was out of Butts County, which is on appeal at the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Briefing is moving along with that. The brief by the sheriff was filed initially. They're the party undertaking the appeal. Our attorney filed our response, and then NARSL and Axel, the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws, we filed a joint amicus brief last week on that case. So that case hopefully will be decided by Halloween, the appeal of the judge's injunction. So that's what's going on with the 11th Circuit with Halloween.
And you are still firmly in the camp that this is just a slam dunk. They don't have a chance of winning. This is the Butts County Sheriff.
Never a slam dunk, but it's going to be hard to turn around the ruling that was won, because the law is so much. Again, Georgia is not the only place where Halloween restrictions happen. The only difference is in Georgia is there are no requirements in the statute. We would like to go down the throats of the people in Missouri, but they have a statute that provides for them. So we have a higher legal standard where there's a statute. In Georgia, this was two renegade sheriffs who decided on their own that they were going to impose a requirement that offenders on the registry, all offenders in their counties, put these signs up. That's what makes it so different. So with the 11th Circuit appeal, they do not have to analyze a statute to determine if what level of deference, whether it's a rational basis or whether it's intermediate scrutiny or whether it's strict scrutiny. They don't have to do any of that. And that's what makes it difficult to imagine how we could lose the case. But since courts are unpredictable, the unpredictable could happen. But it's very difficult for me to conceive how we could lose the case because the sheriff is acting without any lawful authority.
I am constantly reminded, Larry, that in this particular situation and the one with Cobb County, this is one of those cases where, and I don't want to inflate your head so big that you can't walk through a door. You just know this stuff so well, the back side of your hand, the front side of your hand, whichever way you want to look at it, that when you see these things, you don't even, I'm sure you have to like engage some brain power, but you're just like, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And it's just instinctive, and you can just pop these things out that you know that they're wrong. And then you can, the team is in place, the apparatus is in place to formulate a strategy to push back. And it's just overwhelmingly amazing and inspirational that you're able to put these things together this way.
Well, I appreciate that. And a good example was in the letter from the Cobb County Attorney. She said that jurisdictions can exceed the law. And she was talking about the federal law. And she's absolutely correct. A jurisdiction can exceed federal law if the jurisdiction passes those enhanced requirements. The federal law, as it pertains to the SORNA, for example, those are just minimums. That's what the federal government would like you to do if you want your free federal money, to have a registry that does at least these things. You can do more than that list of things. You can register people for longer than what's required, and you can register more offenders than what's required. And when I looked at that, at first blush, I thought, well, gee, she's on the right direction, and she's done a little bit of research here, but she doesn't quite understand what a jurisdiction is. A jurisdiction is a state or a territory, or certain Indian tribes that are recognized. The Cobb County Sheriff's Office is not a jurisdiction.
That one is so weird to me. I still struggle, because to me it is a jurisdiction, because you have county police running around doing things.
But the Cobb County Sheriff's Office is not a jurisdiction itself.
Okay.
It is an entity. It is an agency of a subdivision that is a jurisdiction. But for federal SORNA purposes, it's not a jurisdiction. Cobb County is a jurisdiction.
Right.
But not for federal SORNA purposes. But Cobb County didn't impose these requirements. The Cobb County Sheriff's Office did. The Cobb County Board of County Commissioners did not vote on an ordinance that says that we want our deputies out collecting these verifications on a more regular basis than the state law requires. That would be a different challenge if they had, but they haven't. There is no jurisdictional authority. But for them to cite to the federal law and say a jurisdiction, if Georgia had passed a requirement that rather than you coming in once a year, 72 hours before your birthday, saying that you'll come in 12 times a year, that Georgia could do that. And they're absolutely correct. They could do that, and they could exceed the most that anybody's required to come in to meet federal requirements is 4 times per year. It's either once a year for a tier one, twice a year for a tier two, or 4 times a year for a tier three. And there's no such thing, anything more than for federal purposes, anything more than a tier three. But the state of Georgia, they are a jurisdiction for federal SORNA purposes. They could say that you're going to come in 12 times a year. Georgia could enact that through the legislature, and that would be a jurisdiction.
Right, but that it has to be in the legislature. It has to be part of the statute.
That's correct. And Cobb County Sheriff is not a jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like, for me, it was a no-brainer. It's like, she's either ill-informed the attorney, or she's trying to obfuscate and BS. But no dice. Cobb County Sheriff's Department is not a jurisdiction.
Very, very interesting. It's just funny how you put those together. It's like, you know, I could see something on computer and be like, no, that's not right. I just know, because I've been doing it for 100 years. Like, you've been doing this stuff for 100 years. It's just, I would instinctively know that something is or isn't right. And, mortals don't have any idea.
Well, I didn't know the section of federal law. I knew it was there, but I had to look it up. I had to look at the federal law that defines what a jurisdiction is. But we put that in the letter, and we hopefully informing the county attorney of what constitutes a jurisdiction, and the Cobb County Sheriff's Office is not one.
Absolutely.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
We should move on.
Let's do it.
An individual in chat goes by the name of Nate, gave me this link to this bill that is going through his area, and it is talking about, where'd it go? Oh, Iowa legislators consider criminalizing, here's the key word, Larry, creepy adult relationships with teens. I can see right off the bat, I don't understand what the word creepy, like, we would know, the Supreme Court says, well, I don't know what porn is, but I would know it when I see it. And this would be the same thing. Like, you could kind of guess what creepy means, but how do you define that in the statute of what creepy is? And I wanted to get your expert opinion on how this would, how you might combat this.
Well, I would combat it by saying that what you're trying to do is you're trying to micromanage people's personal lives. And conservatives claim that they are opposed to that. And if I'm not mistaken, this is being led by conservatives, not liberals. But this will be something where you'll end up having a lot of your famous bipartisan support, because it's for protecting young from older predators. And there are people who find that the age of consent, which permits a 16-year-old to have relations with someone of any age, is creepy. And that's their moral values. And that's not for us to do, to impose our moral values on everyone else. And Iowa, if I were there trying to fight that, I would say, well, this is an indirect way of trying to raise the age of consent, is what this really is.
Expand on that, please.
If you're trying to call a relationship creepy because of the age of the person, what you're really trying to do is raise the age of consent. You're trying to say that a person should not be able to consent to have sexual relations with a person more than a certain number of years older than them, or else it's creepy, therefore they shouldn't be allowed to do it, which is effectively raising the age of consent.
I see. It's maybe worded differently. It's an extension of the Romeo and Juliet thing, just inverted, maybe? Because Romeo and Juliet says, you know, like a 21 and a 17-year-old can still have a relationship. But if you extend that out to a 60-year-old and a, I don't know, 17, 20-year-old, does that constitute creepy?
Well, that's what this whole legislation is about. This is what it's about. But again, it's trying to raise the age of consent. The sponsors of it, one of them's quoted saying that he would have a shotgun. He says, my shotgun will be out.
Oh.
Yes, I see that.
60, who said if a 22-year-old starts dating his soon-to-be 16-year-old daughter, my shotgun will be out?
But yet the age of consent is 16 in many states.
Right.
And this is trying to indirectly raise it. Under the bill, a person who engages in sexual activity with a person who is 16 or 17 would be guilty of an aggravated misdemeanor if they are not cohabitating with the consent of the teen's parents and the person is 27 years of age or older. So under this proposal, it becomes very creepy if you're more than 27.
Do you think that this has any legs on it to move anywhere?
Well, sure, I do. I believe it will. Absolutely. It's hard to vote against protecting young people. This is one of those things where I say your famous bipartisan support that you yearn for.
Yes, they'll be, somehow like it's mine.
This, yeah, this is being led by Republicans, but
yes,
it's going to be hard for Democrats to vote against it, because what's going to happen is they're going to be vilified if they do vote against it and say, did you know that Senator so-and-so voted against a bill that would have protected our young from old perverts? I mean, that they would be that blatant with the campaign hit pieces. And if according to this bill, if you're over 27, you're an old pervert.
That is kind of a bizarre number right there, man.
But these are the people who claim that they believe in personal freedom. Now, I get it that the person's not reached the age of majority. And I get that when they haven't reached the age of majority, we get to have a little more input and influence and decision-making about their personal freedom. So I understand that. I don't need a whole bunch of email. But these are people who claim that they want to keep government out of our personal lives.
That's what they say. It doesn't seem to be how they're acting. You know what that sounds like, Larry? That sounds like hypocrisy.
Well, I think we need to hear Lester say that.
For you to come back and call bigots my admirers is a farce. It's an act of hypocrisy. It's a terrible way to treat a guest on your show, and you know it.
Why don't you introduce the Scalia clip for us, please? What are we talking about this time?
We're going to have two clips of Supreme Court tonight. It's going to be spread out, so hopefully the people will listen to the entire podcast to hear the other half of this. It's going to be played later. But this one is about, I think one of the toughest things I have to tell people is that not liking something doesn't make it unconstitutional. And that's not a part of the constitutional analysis. So we're going to hit them with two clips tonight about things that may not seem desirable that are done. And this one's about the death penalty as it applies to young people and what Scalia thinks about the death penalty. And then we're going to come back with a follow-up in terms of what Justice Breyer thinks about Justice Scalia's judicial philosophy on the notion of an evolving standard of decency. So roll this first clip.
Well, let's talk about a specific here to see how your philosophies actually work. The court divided 4 years ago when it ruled that the death penalty for juvenile offenders was unconstitutional. This is for people who commit crimes before the age of 18. Justice Scalia, why do you think it was wrong for the court to conclude that that practice violated the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment?
Because I think what the ban meant in 1791 when it was adopted, it means today. And for example, why not say the death penalty is unconstitutional as applied to everybody, not just people under 18? What stops you from saying that? And indeed, I've sat with four colleagues who said that. What stops you from, and that would just be applying your own sense of what the law ought to be rather than what the law is. What stops you from saying that is in 1791, when the Eighth Amendment was adopted, the death penalty was the only penalty for a felony. There's no argument possible that it was unconstitutional. And it was the same for executing people under 18. There was a common law rule that you would not exercise and execute someone for crimes committed before the age of reason. I think the age was 12. But after that, there was no prohibition. It was rarely done, but it was left up to the jury or the sentencing authority, usually the jury. It may be a very bad idea, and nothing forces the American people to execute people who've committed the most horrible crimes before they're 18-year-old. Nothing requires them to do that. If they think it's a bad idea, they can pass a law in their state which says no one will be executed for anything done under 18. But for this court to just say it doesn't seem to us a good idea and therefore it's unconstitutional, I just don't understand that.
I still continue with these clips that you provide. I don't find wrong in his methodology, and we can, the people, choose to not execute or choose to execute, you know, felony jaywalking is the example I always bring up. But, you know, if we chose to do it, we could make a law that says felony jaywalking and you get nuked. So why don't we, the people, become more engaged to construct the laws the way that we want them to be constructed?
Well, and we did that. Just there's an article somewhere which we can cover and clear it out here from Colorado. Their legislature just passed a bill abolishing capital punishment in the state of Colorado, and the governor has announced that the bill will be signed, and they're doing just exactly that. And that's as precisely, and if you heard some of Scalia's language, it's very similar to what I say about not liking something. That doesn't make it unconstitutional because you disagree with it. Bad public policy doesn't somehow become unconstitutional because it's bad from a policy perspective. It's probably bad to do a lot of things that we do. And the other clip will reveal some additional stuff about how many laws we have that are bad, but they're not unconstitutional.
Right. And because we, the stupid people, can make stupid laws.
So, yes. So Colorado has abolished the death penalty. And if you think that the death penalty is a bad thing, then become active in your state and let's get rid of the death penalty. Let's not ask the people who wear black robes to do for us what we can do for ourselves, because it's not really their role to be the super legislature that decides what's the best public policy. They decide where the Constitution is being violated. And if we have five or more people like Scalia on the court, which I think we do right now, that's why the death penalty has not been declared unconstitutional, the court is not going to save us from ourselves. We're going to have to save ourselves if we object to the death penalty.
So the article that you just alluded to is from Courthouse News. Colorado lawmakers vote to repeal the death, and that's DEF, just kidding, death penalty. They voted 38 to 27, which still means a decent number of peeps up there were in favor of nuking people for various reasons. I assume that the, you know, felony jaywalking is not on their agenda, but like heinous murders and things of that nature are still up on the docket for being executed.
Well, I don't know what all would get you the death penalty in Colorado, would have gotten you the death penalty in Colorado, but the death penalty, if you believe in that original interpretation, and that there's no evolving standards of decency as society progresses, then since the death penalty was a part of colonial times, the death penalty is not unconstitutional because it was widely used in colonial times, and they could not have been thinking about abolishing something that they were using as a punishment at the time they enacted the Constitution. That's Scalia's reasoning. That could not have been cruel and unusual punishment. The reason I like to get on this cruel and unusual punishment, because we get a lot of grief, but, well, Larry, if you guys would just use your brain power. Everybody knows that cruel and unusual punishment, that being on the registry is cruel and unusual punishment. And I said, well, the problem is we haven't even proved in very many instances that the registry is punitive, much less that very high standard of cruel and unusual punishment. If putting people in an electric chair and in a guillotine and in a gas chamber and on a gurney, if that isn't cruel and unusual punishment where you die, it's hard to imagine that any type of supervision or registration or anything short of that would be cruel and unusual punishment. I mean, I just can't see how that you could come up with what is such a high standard of what would constitute cruel and unusual punishment. If the electric chair isn't, what would be?
And didn't we talk about at some point that you being like locked in the stockade and have poo thrown at your face, like that wasn't considered cruel and unusual punishment?
I think that might have been in colonial times. I don't think they did that in colonial times. I don't think were they using that type of punishment back in those days. That was a little bit, but that was about 70 years before I was born.
That's like the Salem witch trial kind of 1500s, 1600s, I guess. But if you'll indulge me, like if that were the standard, then just having your picture and name on the registry, then that certainly wouldn't be considered unconstitutional.
Well, again, I'll put the name and the picture on the registry is merely a dissemination of a public record. If that were all there was to being registered, nothing more, and I'm not advocating for anything like this, but since it has long been established through 200 years of our history that your criminal record, and since we've been taking photographs for the last 100 years, that your mugshot is public, is putting your picture and the fact you're convicted, if they put that on the website and said, go away, have a great life, wouldn't that be equivalent to putting it on the wall of the courthouse, which has always been permissible?
Mm-hmm. But there's certainly, you know, for that example, though, I mean, it's, you know, just walking into your computer room or pulling it up on your phone while you're in your Speedo, that's not hard for you to pull up and find the information about the people that live around you. Going to the courthouse, you know, you're probably going to have to cover up the Speedo to walk into the courthouse, or else they're going to get you for indecent exposure. There's at least some barrier, you know, to not just have some passing interest to get to the information.
Well, then we have to argue that the evolving technology was not something that we should allow to be used for in a modern society. So we would have to say that the founders intended that the information that was public would always require a journey to the courthouse, and that they never envisioned that anybody would get beyond the horse and buggy, because I guess that's what they were largely using in colonial times for transportation. So we would have to argue that and see if that, if the courts would buy that, that's what they intended, that that access to public information would always, you'd have to always go in and get it in person. I don't know that, that I don't know that you could successfully make that claim.
There, I'm completely drawing a blank on the name of the company, but there's a company currently running around scraping up images of everybody that they can find on all of the social media platforms, and they're building this huge database of it. And they just had a massive security breach. So I'm going to hypothesize a scenario where they have then gone around to all of the 50 states registry sites and snagged all of the pictures. Now they have a collection of that. So now it's left the hands of just law enforcement and we could, you know, the control of the government's website. Not that they had control over it necessarily. Anybody can scrape it. But now it's in a mass database doing analysis and comparing and seeing who is with whom and building associations. And that data is then being sold. But now that data has been lost to hackers or whomever, you know, stole it. They had a data breach. Now everything's just out there. And even if you get yourself off the registry, even if you get your picture removed, it's over. It's done.
Yeah, I remember. I think I sent that to you in a link of another data breach. But I don't know what the answer is to all that. That stuff is above my pay grade in terms of securing data and what the consequences should be for breaches. I know one thing: we can't interfere with business because business always does the right thing.
Yeah. Right. Okay. We the people are going to have to decide to do some level of self-regulating, that it is okay that all information isn't available to all people at all times. Sort of like the right to be forgotten that they've adopted in the Europe's, so to speak. Right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
That's what we're going to have to decide.
As a people, we're going to have to decide at what point we can intervene and say information is no longer available. We're going to have that discussion. It's going to be a hard discussion to have, just like other discussions we have. We're having a discussion. We just had a very painful gun discussion here. I think we're in like the 17th state or the 20-something state to adopt the red flag early warning, where the people can have their weapons taken under certain circumstances for a period of time to evaluate if they are a threat. And those are painful discussions because it provokes an emotion. The big old bad government's going to take my gun, and I hadn't committed a crime yet. And the same thing's going to be when we start restricting access to information and requiring that it be expunged, and companies can't conduct their free enterprise. I mean, it's going to be painful. There's going to be a lot of pushback.
All right, we are already at an hour, Larry, and we got so much more to go. So we can cut it whatever we need to cut it to finish out things. But so let's move on to the MDJ, Marietta Daily Journal. Halloween warning signs for Georgia sex offenders trip up lifetime ankle monitoring bill. This doesn't really seem related to me, but so I'm assuming that this is the Butts County Halloween signs. And then we have talked recently about them trying to do something with the GPS monitoring for offenders. Somehow those two collided and they're not going to vote on the bill in Georgia now?
Not yet.
Really sure I understand how all that goes.
Not yet. Well, the bill was in a subcommittee, and of course I don't understand why it's in the judicial non-civil, because the registry is a civil regulatory scheme. So therefore I don't understand why the non-civil judicial committee would be assigned the bill. It should be in the civil, because it's a civil regulatory scheme, but that's a discussion for another podcast. But what's happening is that the attorney who helped us with the Butts County and the Spalding County case, which is also pending in Georgia, he won a case challenging lifetime GPS monitoring for the sexual predators in Georgia, which is a designation bestowed upon people by the Sex Offender Assessment Board, which is like 10, 12, 15 years behind on their assessments of people. And the cost and the inconvenience of having that search and seizure was declared unconstitutional. And Georgia, as most states, are not going to just willingly give up when their laws are declared unconstitutional. So they're trying to reimpose some version of GPS monitoring on the what they say is the worst of the worst, as sexually dangerous predators, as the lawmaker refers to them. Well, while that lawsuit is pending, where we are likely, in my view, to win the appeal, Georgia says, well, gee, maybe NARSL has a point. That since there is no law, maybe we need to make a law. So they amended the bill. They wanted to throw in that signs would be required for people who had multiple sex offenses. And those damn liberal Democrats are pushing back, which they're irrelevant in Georgia because Georgia's majority under Republican control. But there's enough Democrats on this subcommittee that they pushed back, and they were able to keep that amendment from going through. So right now, the bill is in limbo. My prediction is that they will get it out of limbo, and they will move it through the process, because we just can't have those sex offenders unsupervised by GPS, and we can't have these trick-or-treaters go into people's doors. So they're going to try their best to pass a law that says certain sex offenders can't have signs and can't have trick-or-treating. They must have signs in their yards. That's my prediction. That's not what people want to hear, but that's what I expect they'll do.
So then we need people in Georgia to be at the legislature watching for this to try and figure out all of the cool Larry techniques to gum it up to wreck the train when it comes back around next year.
And we also need to be there, which we will be there, and we have been there, to tell them that if you pass it, we're going to come after you again, because just because you pass it doesn't make it constitutional. It enjoys the presumption of constitutionality, but that doesn't mean it's going to be constitutional. You could conceivably narrowly tailor Halloween, conceivably. I haven't done it, but I think you could conceivably tailor a sign and apply it to such a small sliver of people that it might be constitutional. But they're not ever willing to do anything that's so narrowly tailored, because that's the part of the Kabuki show, is to go out and take the cameras and go out to the community and show that these signs are everywhere. If you took the people who actually might pose a threat to a child on Halloween on the registry, it would be such an infinitesimal small number of people, because nothing's ever happened from a sex offender on Halloween that I'm aware of. So right. Since nothing's ever happened, that tells you in and of itself that the risk is very slim. But you could conceivably craft something that would apply in such a narrow way that it might be constitutional. But they're not going to be able to help themselves to do that, because it would not give them the glory that they need, as we're protecting the community. If you analyze a bill, then it's only going to apply to 7 people across the whole state with 38,000 registrants. That's not going to be very appealing to them.
But it does seem to be. So then we could go hit the conservative mindset, like you're going to spend XYZ money for 7 people.
Well, there wouldn't be a whole lot of money spent if you had signs in 7 people's yard. But what would be accomplished? Nothing has ever happened on Halloween. We're fighting an imaginary boogeyman.
Why are we so hell-bent on blaming the boogeyman for all of the problems that we have in this world?
I don't know. Let's start by asking these sponsors of this legislation why they're trying. The courts have spoken. The Georgia High Court has spoken that said you can't do this to people. Why are you coming back? You limited government people who believe in being fiscally responsible, stewards of the persons of the people, of people's resources. So Representative, I don't know how to pronounce that, Sains, S-A-I-N-Z. You'd have to ask Representative Stephen Sains of Woodbine why he's carrying this legislation. Of course, he's carrying it because he was asked to by the law enforcement industrial complex. But why is he carrying this?
Election year political points to stick it to the sex offenders, right?
And the committee that didn't move it, the chairman, Ed Stetzler, Republican of Atworth, said he wants to see some tweaks to the bill, but he expects it to eventually head to the full committee. So I tend to take him at his word. They're going to be able to get it out of the committee.
Very good. All right.
And when everyone's super, no one will be.
We got to move over to an AP news story. Kansas legislation rethink public offender registry rules. I didn't put this in there. This is all you, man. And it's also short.
It's very short. And it's just that finally they've reached a tipping point where they've got so many different registries and so many people on them that they're realizing that they just might have a problem.
Oh, so the expression that there was a movie, you may have heard of the movie. I know you haven't seen it. It's called The Incredibles. It's a really awesome movie, but there's this superhero. He's a supervillain running around. He's like, if everyone is super, then no one is super. So if everyone's on the registry, then no one's on the registry. That makes perfect sense to me, Larry.
It does, yes.
So that's it. So they have decided that they have too many registries, whether that be domestic abuse, animal abuse, sex offender, all that stuff. And then what's the point of all this?
Yeah, they're rethinking that because Kansas has been in financial. They tried the tax cut model with Governor Sam Brownback, and they cut taxes, and the thriving, booming economy that was going to ensue, of course, didn't. It didn't do it in Louisiana either when Jindal did the same thing. And of course, it never does. But they keep selling us that snake oil. But they're so strapped for cash that their Supreme Court declared them to be a violation of the Kansas Constitution in terms of not adequately funding education. So they've had to go back and increase some taxes. I mean, that's hard to imagine that they would do that. But they've had to go back and raise some of the taxes they cut under Brownback. But it's just a fiscal reality that they're dealing with that they're having to rethink some of their ridiculous policies. But if you cut taxes enough, the economy will boom. You got to remember that, Andy. Cut taxes, economy booms.
Couldn't we cut it far enough, you know, and then actually surpass zero and then actually start making it where the government pays us for everything? And then it would be on fire.
Yes, yes. Let's try that.
Okay.
Let's try it.
Yep. Wait a minute. Hang on a second. I just had a thought. Aren't those the same people that rail against the people that are getting some sort of stipend from, and I know everybody's getting one, but I'm talking about the people that are getting like extra and the very poor that are getting, shouldn't their economy be like off the charts?
I'm not understanding that question.
Well, I'm like, so if the rich people are paying taxes and that's what is stipending growth and the poor people are getting, you know, earned income tax credit and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then shouldn't their economy be freaking just gangbusters and then they would not be poor anymore?
Well, there are people who will tell you right now that the poor people are doing quite well. I don't see it with the homeless.
I bet you if you ask them, I bet you they're not doing that.
I don't see it that way, but they will tell you that.
But that tent city we saw in Houston at the conference, that didn't look very appealing to me, not even one little bit.
Well, you've heard me rant about homelessness. We yes. have eradicated homelessness by 1970, and here we're 50 years later, and we have a chronic homeless problem in this country. So I don't understand how we were able to come out of the Great Depression in primitive times and by 1970 provide everyone who wanted to be housing, and we can't figure out how to do it 50 years later. But anyway, let's move on to the next article.
Yes, 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 yes. So from the appeal, Alabama prepares to execute a man whose case is haunted by claims of police misconduct. Why am I not surprised right off the bat that this is Alabama and also a young black man? And I bet you if we go through the article, it's going to be like an 11 person, like 11 white people on the jury. I bet you multiple people say that the one that is being executed didn't do it and so forth. And but Alabama still wants to take him down.
Well, the reason why I zeroed in on it is because he turned down a plea offer based on his advice of his attorney, which told him that Alabama could not gain a conviction of a sufficient severity that would expose him to the death penalty. And he said no, and the lawyer was wrong. And subsequent to that, in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in the Lafleur case, which I have put in the show notes for those legal gurus who want to read it, the Supreme Court decided that when an attorney gives you advice that's wrong, that constitutes ineffective. It's one of the narrow slivers that's left of ineffective assistance of counsel. So this guy has the potential for getting a reversal if the courts are paying attention, if they actually believe in what the Supreme Court decided in Lafleur back in 2012. Now, he's got a clemency case, some sort of executive clemency. I don't mean by releasing him, but some sort of stay. He's got a petition before Governor Riley. Well, being that she signs castration bills, I would not expect her to do anything that would be helpful to this man. But he was sentenced to death before Lafleur, And he refused the plea deal because his attorneys told him, this is an article, that the state had to prove that he pulled the trigger for him to be convicted of capital murder. This was not true under Alabama law, but Woods trusted his attorney's word, according to his 2017 habeas petition. So if they follow Lafler, the habeas court should be able to grant him relief. But the problem is, if they grant him relief and they set aside his conviction, can they convict him again? And if they can't convict him again, does a cop killer go person who was a part of a cop killing team, does he go free? It's a tough case. I'm reticent to say I don't expect good things to happen. I'm sorry to say, but Lafler appears to give him some hope.
Okay. I'm just like, I don't even know that even in a Jeffrey Dahmer case, I'm pro capital punishment. 9/11. I don't think that I'm able to get there, but certainly not for something less than that. Just my personal opinion on where we are. And I think the Alabamians, I don't know if that's the right word, how to pronounce the population of Alabama, they've got work to do.
Well, like I said, I don't expect the governor to grant him any relief. I would be delighted to come back and say that she did, but I don't see her doing anything to intervene.
Fair enough. Let's move over to the crimereport.org. Can tomorrow's prisons look like this? Larry, there's an ottoman in this guy's prison cell. He's got like something that looks like a couch. Maybe that's also his bunk, but it's sort of like a very low back couch. And there's a coffee table. This is never, ever in a million gajillion bajillion years going to happen in the United States.
I tend to have that kind of pessimism, but I mean, we can always have hope that our country will realize that the freedom, loss of freedom, is what the punishment is. Not trying to see what kind of horrible conditions we can subject people to destroy their health, which I think there's an article in here about what prison life does to people, how it takes such a toll on the psychological and the physical health.
Here's one for you. Not that I'm a big fan of vitamins, but not the nutrition level on the prison food is not all that great either. So you have to prove that you, this is so silly. You have to prove that you have some level of deficiency before you can get a prescription so that you can go to pill call to get your either or a pill pack, whatever, of just some sort of basic, you know, Centrum kind of vitamin. It's just unconscionable to me that the way that we treat the people in prison. This isn't just, you know, Parchment is certainly the worst of the worst of the worst that we could expect to have in the American prison system. But it is so atrocious how we treat people. And as you just described, that the loss of liberty and freedom, the loss of access to your family and going to movies and eating pizza and all of that stuff, that's the punishment. You're not supposed to be put under some auspices that you're going to have your life threatened every day. But I know the people that were harmed. Why is this person being treated so well? They should go to be buried under the prison. They should have that threat every day of being sliced by a dagger, whatever. We are not a very humane society here in the United States.
The American people are the most compassionate, gentle people on earth. I am appalled that you would say something like that.
We are exceptional, Larry.
That is correct. All right. So let's move on because we're running
over
long.
The New York. Let's go over to the New York Times, and it will be really quick here. But full coverage, Harvey Weinstein is found guilty of rape. The piece of this that I just find so overwhelmingly bizarre is, and I certainly can't speak for the women that are in the position that then take on these acts, but after the act of rape, the alleged act of rape, that they then continue a relationship with the person and then have consensual sex, that one just blows my mind that's how these situations, some of them came down.
Well, it doesn't blow my mind quite as much as it blows yours because and I'm trying to think of a gentle way. There's never a gentle way to say what I'm trying to communicate. But people who have immense amount of power can persuade people to do things that they would not want to do, given normal circumstances. Well, Harvey Weinstein had an enormous amount of power in terms of people's careers. So then the question for me becomes, we trade our entire life trying to jockey for position and trying to align ourselves with people that can help us. Very few people align themselves with people that are going to harm them knowingly. I mean, if you're trying to get ahead and trying to advance your career, you generally don't look to the telephone book if you could find one and say, gee, I wonder who could stall my career. Let me call them. and align myself with them. So you're making a calculation of who to align yourself with, alter your life trying to achieve your goals. So then the question becomes, if part of achieving your goals is to volunteer to do sex, is that a decision that you get to have buyer's remorse about later if you don't achieve your goals? Now, that is not the same thing as someone who is grabbed and groped and is forcibly engaged, has someone force themselves on them. But there is a lot of sex that happens because people are trying to work themselves into better positions. And I'm not so sure that we can turn around after and call that rape. We can call it inappropriate behavior. We can call it abuse of power. But I'm not so sure it's rape if you've got consenting adults. I'm just struggling with that.
Mm-hmm. I agree and understand. All right, so we weren't going to stick on that for very long. But he is getting 25?
Well, he hasn't been sentenced yet, but he's exposed to, I think, either 25 or 29 years. The point I put in there was they use 404B witnesses, meaning people who say that he did similar things to them as a part of the trial. They were not the victims in this case, and they got to testify. If you can get that type of evidence in, if you can have someone in come in who has not been, who their case is not before the court, and they can say that a person has a pattern of gross behavior, you can convict anybody of practically anything. So the 404B, the propensity evidence is dangerous, and it sunk his ship. That they didn't convict him on the predatory, the most serious
yes
offenses, but they've got enough that he'll die in prison.
Certainly that. And the 404B thing that you're talking about, that is the Cosby issue as well?
The Cosby issue, yeah. The propensity evidence where a person, they can use a testimony of other accusers who were not charged, who he was not charged with a sexual crime against them. They were able to testify against him because of the similarity in the allegations.
And were there any other high-profile cases that have come up recently like that? It's the only one that I can think of offhand.
Well, if 404B is a common thing, particularly in sex cases, but I'm not thinking of any other high-profile cases, but it might have come up in Nassar, or it might have come up in some of these where there's been serial accusations. It's dangerous, though.
Yep.
That is why I am here.
All right, then over at the Hill, why prosecutorial discretion must be less discreet for criminal justice? Larry, I'll be honest, I read it, and still kind of went over my head. That's why you're here. I think I need that clip. That's why I am here.
The reason I put it in here, and it doesn't require a lot of time, is this is another case where I like to harp about where the conservatives say that they're in favor of local control. But this is a case of legislators saying, wait a minute, we don't like the fact that you're not prosecuting these things. And we want to second guess you. I believe this came out of Indiana. So it's just a little bit of that hypocrisy that we talk about.
Hypocrisy. Again, hypocrisy. Yep. We need to get more you peoples. That's what we really need.
I've done you people tonight.
I have heard it. And then the chat goes crazy with all of the subsequent you peoples. There's just this echo reverberating around in chat. Hey, thank you everyone for showing up in chat. We have like a monster full house, by the way, Larry.
Oh, really? I haven't even looked.
Yeah, I'm over there chatting constantly.
Well, I'm not capable of doing what you're able to do. I can't participate.
I'm capable either.
I completely turn that screen off when I'm doing this.
I don't blame you. Let's move over to the appeal, and we got a quick little snarky little article. It says, in a Florida courtroom, people charged with probation violations face humiliation from the judge. The story that they profiled was a woman who had, she had started maybe beating up her husband a little bit, but maybe she was having some sort of mental issue breakdown, something like that. And I don't want to be insensitive to the actual, like the terms to be used. But so she has a probation violation based on having an episode. And the judge says, well, you know, even considering all that, you'll be sentenced according to the guidelines, which is 24.9 months in Florida State Prison for a probation violation, as I understand it, which is, and he says, once that is over, hopefully you can live your life and be crime-free. Have a good day. And the judge banged his gavel. That seems really harsh, man.
Well, this woman does appear that she has some significant mental issues with the drugs, the list. I don't understand what all these are, but she her victim was there pulling for her not to be sent to prison. And of course, that's the other side of that coin. You know, when people say the victims, they like to give them credibility, and they like to when they want harshness, but when they want leniency, it's amazing that didn't carry any weight on the sentencing that the judge still gave her. But this is a bigger story of Hillsborough County, Florida, Tampa area. The judge apparently has some real issues with being polite, courteous, and considerate, and following due process, and is not just known for being very very obnoxious. And of Hillsborough's 7,900 violations, 69% did not allege any commission of any new criminal offense. And despite the lack of new offense, 40% of those technical violations resulted in jail or prison time. In addition, according to Florida's Office of Economic Demographic Research, imprisonment rates for technical violations statewide fell from 33% in 2014-15 to 31.9% in 2018. But the 13th Circuit, which is Hillsborough County, constitutes a disproportionate a number of those people that get sent to prison for technical violations. So there it is again, you know, the state that's so much smarter because they have all the conservative leanings to know how to decipher government waste. They're able to send people to prison for long periods of time and have one of the highest incarceration rates in the nation because of people like this judge.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it. How about back over the crime report? It says prison lifer numbers now exceed 1970 incarcerated population. So, I mean, shouldn't we just look at this, Larry, that obviously the population has increased? I think we had 200 million people roughly in 1970, and now we're in the 330s. So isn't this just a scaling thing that eventually the number of people with life sentences would be over the prison population from a previous time?
No, because the prison population has increased about sevenfold since 1970.
Sevenfold? And we've only had about a 50-ish percent, a little bit more than that?
Yeah, so
in population total?
Yeah, that's the point I was making, is that the rate of incarceration in 1970, I don't think that we would say that the crime was so rampant that you were having to scurry for cover in most parts of the country. So in 1970, we incarcerated at 1/7 the rate we do today. And somehow or another, we managed to make it through 1970 okay. And now we have a 700% increase in our incarceration rate, and more people incarcerated for life than the entire incarcerated population in 1970. That's quite remarkable.
Doesn't it say 1 in 7? It says the number of people serving... No. Where is it? It says 1 of every 7 people in U.S. prisons is serving a life sentence. That is a disgusting number.
Well, the states that have done that have decided that in some cases that they've gone too far and they're trying to back away from it. But it's hard to undo these things when you've got people sentenced to life, because trying to figure out who you can... When you say they were sentenced to life in prison, the reaction to the average person would be similar to a level 3 sex offender. You use the term level 3 sex offender, that sounds bad. Well, a lifer sounds bad too, except they might have had 3 relatively minor felonies that might have been.
Yes, no, three strikes, you're outlaws, right?
Right, and so that doesn't necessarily, a lifer doesn't necessarily translate to a really bad person. What it does translate to is that if you actually keep them for life, you're going to have a very expensive inmate as the years go by, and you're going to have a decreasing threat to society, if there ever was a threat to society, because once they get past a certain age, the propensity for criminality drops so precipitously that you could turn most of those people loose after they're 35 and probably wouldn't have any more problem out of them. But so that's what we learned from that, but we haven't learned that. We know it, but we haven't learned it and implemented the changes we would need to do to stop warehousing these people for their entire lives.
What is the disconnect in understanding, how do I want to word this? The population just wants them off the street, I think. But what is the disconnect in then rehabilitation to not recidivate? So now we just make sentences longer and longer and longer. We just get them out of sight, out of mind for forever, essentially. Like, what's the disconnect there why don't we understand that we do want these people back in society? I would think that we want them back because it is somebody's loved one. And we would want them living some kind of productive, prosperous life and so forth. Where's the disconnect? I still don't quite get that.
Well, I think that people do want the folks back in society. But once you've been labeled a lifer, the point I was making is that the perception is that's a very bad person. that would be someone President Trump would refer to as our bad hombres.
Bad hungries.
No, hombres.
Not hombres? Oh. I think he said hombres once, Larry.
But we have some bad hombres here, and we're going to get them out.
Well, yeah, so the people, it's a lack of understanding who's in prison, who constitutes. In order to understand some of these complex issues, you actually have to give up an afternoon of something that you would enjoy. And most people don't want to do the study to figure out. The average citizen knows that we've got lifers in prison, and they know that as far as they're hearing on the news, that they're not safe, that crime is running rampant, although it isn't. And they want to feel safe. That's what the average person knows. You have to be above average in terms of your taking the time to understand the criminal justice system to know more than the average person. All they know is they feel unsafe.
And we have a companion article that goes with that one from The Appeal that says life sentences lock away too many people and too much potential. Just covering the same thing, but from their point of view. And it is a massive amount of human capital wasted to do all sorts of things, whatever those are, to, you know, super high-end computer programmers, to whatever job, you know, even down to like your local grocery store bagger. You know, there's just a lot of wasted potential just sitting behind the walls.
It's tragic, but hopefully that'll change in my lifetime. We are making progress towards, there's a lot of support for what is it called? In mass incarceration.
Sure.
That's a movement that's actually gaining traction.
I do have
hope that we will recognize that we're locking up too many people.
In your lifetime?
I think in my lifetime we could see that.
Okay. And second to last, here we have a California bill that would seal 2 million criminal records. This is from AP News. I got to think that this is a good thing, but someone's not going to be happy about, like, damn it, I need to know that this person did a bad thing so many years ago, because I need to know all the things about people.
Well, it's gonna face a tough process to get through, but the proposal would automatically clear records dating back to 1973, but I'm not clear of the nuances of who all would be clear. I'm fairly certain that sex offenses would be excluded. I mean, they always do manage to exclude that from everything. So, but at least it's a positive. I always tell people if we can't get everything we want, we take the steps to get as much as we can. And if Armageddon doesn't happen, we can come back later and say, see, in 2020, we sealed 2 million records and the crime rates in California have not gone through the roof. All life as we know it didn't end. So let's go back and look at the remainder of people who have records and talk about who else's we can seal. If we can't get it all, why not get as much as we can? And the other side of that, people say, well, you're throwing everybody under the bus, Larry. You're just throwing people under the bus. And no, I'm, if a criminal record is as bad as I think it is, and if it hampers your productivity and does as much damage, I want to save all I can. If I can't save everybody, I want to save as many as I can. If we can make 2 million people's life better, isn't that a good thing?
Brenda wants to know, why do you lisp when you're quoting people?
I learned it from Rush.
Oh, is that right? He's your idol, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but he has 30 million listeners a week. We're just slightly under that number.
We're slightly under that.
I got my rights to do anything I want to do. I'm a police officer.
I totally didn't mean to skip this article, but the did you see all the rage about this little 6-year-old girl that got handcuffed?
I did, and I think it's remarkable that an adult individual that wears a badge of any law enforcement agency cannot figure out a way that's not traumatizing to restrain a 6-year-old, even if restraint is even needed. I don't know what the 6-year-old was doing, if the 6-year-old was going crazy, but if a 6-year-old is going crazy, an adult has enough strength to hold a 6-year-old till the 6-year-old completely runs out of energy. Mm-hmm. And then if the 6-year-old restores the energy and wants to fight some more, you would use the softest restraint you could find. You would pull off your bandana, your headscarf or something, and you would tell the 6-year-old, now I'm going to have to do this because you're wailing and you're going to hurt yourself or somebody. And I'm going to have to tie your hands until you run out of energy. And when you agree to quit being combat if we're going to take the scarf off your hands. That's all you would do. You would never take the plastic wraps that you'd put on when you run out of handcuffs when you're doing a drug raid. You would never put twist ties on a 6-year-old, for heaven's sakes.
This is so bizarre. So the video, you find it probably all over the internet. I almost feel bad for the police officers, because they're probably getting their houses are probably being tomatoed and whatnot. But the girl's like, well, what are those? And like, well, those are some cuffs. And like, well, who are they for? They're for you. And she starts wailing. She's like, what? Ah! And she's just crying. And they walk around, they put her in the back of a police car. She's 6 years old. Someone also told me that she has some sort of disability of some sort. So she's not what's the right word? A normal? I forgot what did Nick Dublin say about, I think he called us cognitive normals or something like that. I forgot the term he used. But this girl has some sort of disability.
Clearly,
unbelievable.
But I don't know why we're going to end up having to make a law, because the agencies the command staff of these agencies can't just simply say don't handcuff, don't put any type of restraint on a child below a certain age, and if you do have to use the softest restraint that you can find.
This is like the pregnancy handcuff thingamajigger, the restraints for the pregnant ladies.
Yes, but we'll have to pass a law because they cannot use their brain to not do that. You should never find the need to handcuff a 6-year-old.
Couldn't the cop, like, you know, he's got the radio there on his shoulder, like, hey, dispatch, can I speak to the captain? Do you really want me to put cuffs on the 6-year-old? And he's like, damn it, I said put cuffs on anybody that's acting disorderly. And they're like, okay. And, like, this is a media shitstorm for him.
Well, if I were the officer, if I got that command, I would refuse to follow it. I'd say, sorry, Captain, I'm not going to do that. I've got a child that I'm not going to put restraints on a child. Sorry. Yeah, I'll sit there and hold her if I have to, but I'm not going to do that.
Yes. Larry, are you ready to move over to part two of the Scalia clip?
Scalia?
Scalia. Isn't that how you call it?
Well, I do that off the air, but not on the air.
I think you would tell me that it was being super disrespectful to a Supreme Court justice, correct?
Well, a friend of mine, when he got appointed, he asked me that. He said, what do you know about this Scalia?
Oh, really?
You know, I had no idea who he was talking about. He said, Reagan appointed this guy named Scalia. He said, do you know anything about him? And I said, well, no, just what they're saying in the news. And I said, but I didn't hear it pronounced that way. I thought it was Scalia. Oh, okay. That's what. And then, so that goes back to like a friend of mine from the 1980s. I think he got appointed in 86, if I remember.
And this is part two. This is a conversation. This is a moderator, I guess, having a conversation between Scalia and then Breyer. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is Justice Breyer. And this is going to enlighten us again on whether or not the Constitution evolves, and also whether or not, if you don't like something, that magically transforms it to be unconstitutional. That's the point of this clip, is to contrast the rigid ideology of a Scalia versus what Breyer. Now, this is a 57-minute program, so we've only put a few minutes between these two clips. So, you guys that want to watch it, you can just go watch the entire 57 minutes. It's a great clip. It's a great exchange between the two ideologies.
And this is about 3 minutes long. So here we go.
I don't know the exact details of what everybody in the 18th century thought was cruel and unusual, but they didn't enact that. They enacted into law cruel and unusual punishment, which meant a set of values, not a specific set of 18th century circumstances. So for me, the question would be, how do those values that they enacted then apply to our circumstances today? Now, I think most people, I don't mean get everybody, but I think you get a pretty broad consensus that you should not execute people for robbery today, or for theft, or for all felonies. Nor do I think everybody today would say it's fine to execute a 13-year-old. So when we look around the world and look around the United States, and we see there's hardly anybody that executes a child, even one over 12, the question becomes, well, where do we draw the line today? Not where they drew the line in the 18th century, but where do we draw the line today in terms of the values that they enacted into that Constitution in the 18th century? And I'll tell you, that becomes a difficult question. Should it be 18, 17, 16, 15? I don't think anybody's going to go down to 12. But how to do that and figure it out and try to do it in a way that has some objective appeal and not just what I subjectively feel. That's why the job's a difficult job, as the job is a difficult job for judges. But that's the point of disagreement, I think. How you do that in a particular case.
Well, what circumstances have changed?
I mean, you want to execute people?
Death was death then. Death is death now. 18 was 18 then. 18 is 18 now. You're talking about applying different values. I agree with you that they were enacting a value judgment, but it was a value judgment of that time. You do not have to adhere to that value judgment. If indeed you think you shouldn't execute people under 18, fine, pass a law. But once you abandon what they meant by cruel and unusual punishment and say, oh yeah, even though they didn't think it covered the death penalty, we think it does, you are at sea. And it is, as you say, a difficult job. Steve, I don't know how you do it. I'm just glad that I don't play that game. I mean, I would lie awake at night, you know?
Are you going to execute people? Are you going to execute people for embezzlement? Are you going to execute them? I mean, you won't for parking tickets,
look,
I know.
What about speeding?
What about
you make the example, the less likely it is to occur. I would not execute people for embezzlement, but it's not unconstitutional.
What about practices that were followed at the time of the founding? Ear notching, the pillory. If cases like that arose, would you find likely that they're constitutional?
I'd find they're constitutional and stupid. Listen, a lot of stuff that is constitutional, an enormous amount of stuff that's constitutional is stupid. That cannot be the test.
No,
whether it is really stupid.
Constitutional but stupid, right?
And we've played a similar clip before, and I use that for helping people understand not liking something doesn't transform it to be unconstitutional. That's not a test. It's seldom a test, and it really shouldn't be a test because the courts do not exist. They did not create that branch of government to be a super referee of what we impose on ourselves through our elected officials. It's a super referee to stand guard for when we do things that do violate clearly what's in the Constitution. And we don't have a lot of things that we think are in the Constitution are not in the Constitution. People argue all the time they have a right to free speech. Well, you do to the extent that the government is interfering with that right. But you don't have a right to commandeer someone else's platform to use it to convey your message. And I say, well, why don't you go to the church on Sunday and tell them, hey, I kind of don't really agree with what comes out of his pulpit every Sunday, and I'd like to have your microphone this week because I have a counter message. And find out how much free speech you have. You have absolutely no constitutional right to their microphone. But now, on the other hand, if government comes in and says, you cannot be in that facility on Sunday morning because the government doesn't want you there, then you have a constitutional right because government doesn't have any business interfering in your exercise of religion or how you choose to speak, if the church chooses to let you speak, or whether that's up to them. But things that we think are constitutional rights are not constitutional rights. It's the way what he said in the first clip about where the way it should be versus the way it is. And that's where I get the should be versus is be. A lot of things should be a certain way, but they're not because we haven't made them that way.
I know you don't know inside the brain of Mr. Scalia, but it could be construed that he's actually trying to go about it like, hey, man, I want to just go about this the easiest, the laziest way possible. And I don't want to, hey, if it doesn't fit inside of this mold of what is or isn't constitutional, I don't have to think about it.
That'd be one way to imagine him. I think that I wouldn't be quite as sinister. I think that he believes he's protecting the Constitution. He believes that it can evolve both ways. He believes that the evolving standard of decency can become an evolving standard of tyranny. And he cites to the erosion of the Confrontation Clause, which he, to his credit, helped restore the Confrontation Clause during his term on the court. But he believes that if the Constitution can evolve, it can evolve in a dangerous way. So I believe that lazy may not be his entire motivation. I believe that he's fearful of evolution. Now, Breyer says that he's not seen evidence of it evolving in a negative way. But theoretically, if the Constitution can evolve, what would stop it? It certainly, if you have a strong enough, if you have the victims' advocates who, if they gain sufficient power, why can't we evolve out a bunch of constitutional rights if that's what the people want in large numbers? Why wouldn't Scalia be right to be afraid?
It seems that Breyer would probably sit there and have the same sort of argument that he's just protecting what he believes is the purpose of the Constitution, just the same as Scalia is.
Absolutely, and that's the whole point that these clips make, is that legal minds can disagree. And that appeal that's going on in Georgia in the 11th Circuit right now, we're both arguing the mootness doctrine. And we're both right. Both sides are arguing the mootness doctrine, saying the case is moot for a different we're saying it's moot for our reasons, because we don't want a decision that reverses the injunction. And the sheriff is saying that this one is an exception to the mootness doctrine, and here's why. And their arguments for what they have properly cited, what the exceptions are to a mootness doctrine, and that's an issue that's capable of repetition, but there wasn't sufficient time for it to be reviewed because of the compact time. Well, they had a very compact time to respond. We filed the lawsuit in October. It was decided at a very short turnaround time. There was no time for an appeal. The injunction was issued on the 29th. They're absolutely correct. They had 2 days. They could not possibly perfect an appeal. So they're saying that they should be able to have their belated appeal now. They're accurately and correctly arguing the exception to the mootness doctrine. We're saying the damn thing's moot. The judge granted it. It was good for 2019. Halloween's over. The injunction is now dissolved, and the case is over, and it should be dismissed. Where you can be looking at the exact same situation, and you can completely rationally disagree in terms of how the law should be applied.
One final question that I have for you here is, why is it that only the right-leaning folks are considered like constitutionalists, originalists, pick your term there, and the lefties are trying to destroy the Constitution? Isn't there some sort of ground to say that I'm trying to protect these things like the Confrontation Clause, but I have left-leaning politics, but I still respect all of the principles that are there? Second Amendment, why doesn't that exist? It doesn't seem that it does, but doesn't that exist?
Well, I resent that when people say that. It's kind of like when they say that they vote for a candidate because they look at the bigger picture. To mm-hmm. say that the people that come from a more liberal ideology somehow don't love this Constitution and cherish the values and love this great country is so absurd and offensive. It is so absurd. I mean, the right-wingers love to say that Obama was trying to destroy the country. He was not mm-hmm. doing no such thing. He was a very patriotic.
There go all the rest of the listeners.
And Senator McCain said that to one of his supporters that came up to him when he was running against Obama, and she said, I'm afraid of this man, and he's not a patriotic, something to that effect, and he said, no, ma'am, he's a very patriotic. The people who say that the lefties are trying to destroy the Constitution, it's ridiculous. We cherish the Constitution. We cherish the Constitution as much as you do.
Yeah.
We just happen to believe that the Constitution does different things in different ways than what you believe.
Finally, Larry, we are almost ready to get out of here. I have a voicemail from Super Patron Mike in Florida again and has another question for you. Are you ready to go?
Let's do it.
Hey, guys. It's Mike again this week down here in Central Florida. I had a question and a request. My question is, in the states, in the near future, when some of these laws or these restrictions that we have are overturned and deemed unconstitutional, things have changed, such as the stuff that we've been talking about in Michigan. For some of the registrants who were from pre-2006 and way back, if any of those people get relief and they're dropped from the registry, here's my question. If they had any technical violations during those years that they were on the registry, will those technical violations stand, or will they have grounds to go back and have those sealed or removed? I'm not sure how that works, so I'm sure I'm using the wrong terminology. But anyway, I was just thinking about that this week, and would they have a leg to stand on if they wanted to say, hey, listen, this was never legal in the first place. Could we go back and, you know, get something like that maybe expunged or whatever the case may be? But anyway, that was my question, and my statement is for the other 50,000 listeners that listen to this podcast every week. I need you guys to call in and let's get some voicemails on here and save the voicemail. You know, Larry likes the voicemails. And he's a big part of what we're doing here, so I need you guys to step up and help me call in with some good questions. Other than that, I appreciate what you guys do, and a big old FYP to anybody who don't listen to this podcast. Thanks, guys.
How about that from Mike?
That is actually a fantastic question, and it is going to be on the list of questions that will come up on the Norseland Action National Litigation Review Monday night. And to my chagrin, I was not the thinker of the question. It has been one that's been raised several times through the ACLU, to the ACLU, through our contact that works with the ACLU there in Michigan. And he submitted it to me as a proposed question, and I love it. So it's going to be asked. I don't know the answer to it. It stands to reason that they would be able to, if the greater question within that, with what he's wanting to know, what about the people that are serving prison time right now for violating that? Because mm-hmm. Michigan may not have many states will count that as a habitual felony. We don't, it's exempt because it's a civil regulatory scheme. So it's not a felony that's eligible for enhancement in my state. But what about the people who that may have been their third, fourth felony conviction? What about those people who are either still in prison or still on supervisory control? What happens to their conviction? Would they be able to be released? I don't know the answer to that. It seems like they would, but on the other hand, what about when in the case of Gennaro Wilson in Georgia, where the young man who had sex he was 17, she was 15, and it was consensual and it was a felony, and he got the Georgia Supreme Court and declared that to be a cruel and unusual punishment under the state constitution. It only applied to him. All the hundreds of young men that were in prison, the state of Georgia fought vigorously to keep them incarcerated. And Attorney General Baker at the time, old Thurbert, as his name was, Thurbert said that that's exactly where they belonged. So if Michigan would follow that model of Georgia, they would try as hard as they can to secure those convictions they have, and they would fight tooth and nail not to let anybody have them undone. That would be my expectation.
All right, then. What about the second part of the statement? Oh, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, it'll be on the podcast on the Norseland Action, and we'll ask that to the attorney. And what was the second part of the question? I've got old timers.
Well, he had just said that I think the statement was basically we need to keep the voicemail system going because you're all about some voicemails, and FYP to all of those that don't listen to the podcast.
Well, I agree with the voicemails. They're great, particularly when they're well thought out questions, and that was a great question.
Mike's a pretty sharp cat. Larry, I'm going to tease this, that I have something pretty exciting that I'm going to release very soon on the YouTubes. It may happen this week. I don't know if I will finally make it through, but I'm going to try and kick it over the into the goalpost. You've seen it. What do you think? Should I do it?
I think it's a stellar job that you've done on that video, and I wish I could speak as stutter-proof as you did in there.
A lot of practicing. So yeah, I might be able to release that, and then maybe with your assistance to try and come up with something on a, I don't know, weekly, every other week, once a month, something like that, to try and release something. So there's your teaser, and I think that can close out the show, Larry. How do people find us on the internet?
Very carefully.
Of course, always carefully.
Very, very carefully, though.
Even very. Gotcha.
So isn't it registrymatters.co?
It is. It is registrymatters.co. And again, don't ask me why it's a CO, why it's a CO and not a .com. I have no idea what I was thinking when I did that. But it is a .co, not a .com. How about your favorite thing, a phone number? How do people reach us by the old school stringing two cans together with a string?
If you still have a working phone, call 747-227-4477. I started to say dial, but no one dials, and they haven't anymore.
Does
anybody even
know how to dial anymore?
Yeah,
and we have operators standing by 24/7, and for the low of $19.95, you can have your anyway.
And then you can send us an email if you like to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Fantastic. And of course, we love all of our patrons, but if you would like to, and we would love it if you would, get together, put together $1, $2, $100, $1 million, and you can support the podcast and the efforts and all of the brainiacness that Larry is. People go where, Larry?
Oh, that would be patreon.com/registrymatters.
Fan freaking tastic. You know what, though? We also get a ton of people listening to the show on YouTube. Go over there and subscribe, and that would be amazing. And you could find us on Twitter. And these are all Registry Matters at these different places, I think, other than Registry Matters Cast, because I was a dum-dum and forgot the password when I created the email account. That's another story entirely as well.
So you can't check the email?
I can check this one, but I had an original one and I forgot the password. But that's 2.5 years ago now.
So, well, what about Spotify? Can they find us there?
Yes, you can find us on Spotify. iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Pandora. It's everywhere.
All right, Larry.
I hope you have a splendid Saturday night.
Well, I'm in the chat room now. It's packed to the gills.
It is. We had a bunch of people, and I so very much appreciate chat. You can find a link in the show notes if you want to come join us over on Discord, and you can harass me and talk to all of the other peoples. And yes, and somebody in chat is saying the OK and then the G word, play Registry Matters. I'm not going to say that because all my stuff would fire up in here. So, but you can do that, yes, and the A word too. It is on all of those platforms. Larry, I hope you have a splendid night, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.